Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, product owners all around this great big old wide world we live in, welcome back to Deliver It. This is your Agile Product Owners Podcast. My name is Corey Bryan, and today I am exhausted. I'm on the last bit of energy that I could possibly muster because, oh my God, things are just going all kinds of wrong. You ever work in crisis mode? I'm in crisis mode right now. I've had some really good things, though. I finally got to start working again with a UX person. I really like working with UX people and talking through things and seeing how they approach problems, and I love it. So finally, I get that, even if it's for a little bit. I appreciate it. And I've been able to work with a new team, new university team, student team, to create a new application experiment for us at work. So been meeting with those guys twice, and really good team, really excited about doing the work and really invested in, seeing it succeed. So like seeing that, like talking to those guys. Those are all positive things, and that's what I'm going to focus on, because if I talk about the negative things, I'll just go off on a soapbox. So we won't do that. And you're welcome. A couple of things that I really did like this week that I read or saw. The Agile 2017 big conference was a couple weeks ago, and they've started releasing some of their videos, which are actually really good. There's one that I really, really like, and I've shared around a couple times. And it's got a book attached to it, of course, so I'm going to have to read the book. But it's from David Marquet, and the talk is about creating leadership and engagement at every level. David was a submarine captain, and his book is Turn the Ship Around, how the USS Santa Fe went from worst to first in the Navy. And really, it's about how he was able to do that and how he was able to create a leadership environment for everybody on the ship. So it wasn't just him, which is what he was taught to do as a captain, is give orders. And he actually got to the point where he said he wasn't going to give any more orders. Something happened, and he decided that he wasn't going to give any more orders. And how do you do that? How are you a captain on a nuclear submarine without giving orders? And the book and the talk is really about how he did that. And it really is about leadership with intent. So they talked about intents a lot. So the staff, the people, manning the submarine, the officers, the captain, they all talked with what they intended to do. So it stopped being, tell me what to do. And they started talking about what they have been doing. And there's a really cool leadership ladder that he has there about phrasing and about asking and about telling and how you do that and work toward the point where you have, instead of one leader on the ship and 135 followers, you have 135 leaders and how that really got there. And it really is powerful stuff. The questions that he asked and the way he behaved and the way he leaned back and let the team or the individuals lean in and start doing that some of that stuff their own. And he really did it without, changing the crew. It just was the way that the crew behaved together and the way their teams kind of interacted is really what made that change. He goes into talk a lot about red work and blue work. So thinking work and doing work. The fact that, work we have to do is kind of, you just do it. And then there's work you have to think about doing and how that works. And he related it a lot to agile practices. And it's nice seeing that agile mentality or that agile leadership style that we've been talking about in a whole other context and how it's applied there. And then how we can apply some of that to what we're doing as leaders and as product owners. So really good talk, great talk. I've watched about 5 different versions of it because it's just very interesting. And he's got some other videos, leadership videos, and of course his book. So really encourage you to check that out. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Another thing that I saw recently was from my friend Austin, who let me know about a gentleman named Ryan Vandermeer and his post, which is the biggest mistakes product managers make and how to avoid them. And it really dives into knowledge management and how do we know what we know? How do we talk about what we know? He's got a great phrase in there that basically forms a pyramid of knowledge and how to go through things. He says we collect data, we group that data into information. So those are the bottom two rows. Data is the bottom. Information is kind of the next row up. And then we discuss it to extract the knowledge, which is the third layer, and wisdom, which is the top layer, that we need to make the appropriate changes to our product. And that you really can't skip those phases. And that's an interesting concept to me, because knowledge or wisdom, I think, could come from experience. And experience is not one of the things on here. I like it enough to say this is something you should look at and something you could see, you know, is it applicable in your in world, or could you make it applicable to your world? It's really speaking to what I'm trying to do with some of our analytic data and some of our audit data. I'm trying to go through that data, process it into information so that we can gain some knowledge about what to build first and then go with that. So I like his idea there with that pyramid. And apparently Ryan's got a book out as well, which of course I'm still reading too many books, but I will definitely add that one to my list and would like for you to check out that article.
No doubt that this magnificent vessel will give excellent value for the dollars she'll be earning.
So lately, I've been obsessed with the concept of flow. I'm sure you've heard it sprinkled here and there over the last few episodes, and it's really related to a lot of things that I've been reading, watching, and doing lately. The connective tissue, it seems, are all ties back to the idea of flow. I was discussing this with Maureen, my coach, who was on this some earlier episodes, and she didn't think I should be concerned about flow. The idea was something for the team and the scrum master, but not necessarily the product owner. It's possible I didn't explain the idea enough to her that I had. It's possible she's right. And it's also something that we product owners may need to understand more about. So today I'm going to go through some of my thoughts more in depth and see if I can't find something that's good enough for us. The flow concept can be applied, I think, in three different scenarios, or better yet, we as product owners should look for flow in three different ways. The first way, and the one that we've discussed the most, is the flow of work through a system. What does it take to get something done with the team? The second way is the people doing the work themselves, and this includes what we are doing. Are our teams and ourselves able to get into the zone and flow? Third is the idea of users in our applications. How can we build applications with their goals and needs met in the simplest way possible? In each of these scenarios, the concept of flow is important. The idea of movement is what's intriguing here. What is moving? How is it continuing to move? How fast is it moving? Is it stopping at all? The fact that something stops kills flow. The chance of something slowing down but not stopping isn't as bad. The flow is lowered. And why is that? When people want to talk and discuss, argue, about efficiency metrics or resource utilization, instead of engaging them on that ground, how can I turn the conversation back to flow, back to getting work done? When I open conversations about being more effective, it's because of the needs in each of the sections to flow solutions to problems that we're delivering. For the users of our products, our applications, our systems, how easy is it for them to do their job or find the product they want and to purchase it, maybe to send a message or to see if a message was received? Keeping the user in front of the discussions and what they're trying to do will help eliminate a lot of conversations that aren't adding value. Even if you haven't yet established your personas, you should know who's using your product, what they're trying to do, even if it's just a simple goal that you put forth. How hard do your users have to work to accomplish that? What things can you remove to make it better? I'm going through an exercise where we don't have user data or analytics as I would like, but we do have an audit data table for the last 2 years at the database level. I need this data so I can see how our users are interacting with our legacy system. With it, I can see what they do most often and build a system to help them do that better. I can go to our management, our teams, our users themselves and say, this is what I see happening. Can we talk about what you're trying to do here? When I select an area that has the most usage and I get pushback from someone, I can show them the data. With the data and the conversation about it, we can start to sketch out some workflows, not in the application. Just end to end, what are you trying to do? Not how, not screen, not where. At the end of this effort, what are you trying to do or decide? That will help me, the team, and you design a better solution for that. After the conversation is written out on a whiteboard or on cards or on whatever, you can start to build more into it. Maybe some wireframes, maybe some paper prototypes or whiteboard sessions. Anything that lets you and the users and the team communicate with intent. I also touched on the second area of flow, that of the personal flow, in my time management episode. The same is true of the team and what they need to get into a state of flow or in the zone. We've discussed before the notion that product owners can help make it easier for the team to get into and stay in that state by giving them uninterrupted time to work. That could be as simple as no meetings in the afternoon or during a four-hour block of the day. Maybe making Thursdays a no-meeting day would help. I've been at places where the team would put up a flag or some other indicator if they were deep into something and didn't want to be disturbed. The team would respect that, and even if it's a pair or group trying to plow through a tricky issue, let them at it. Any interruptions or distractions need to go away. When the team can get into flow, their morale improves. They are more attached to their work, who it's for, and can work through ideas better. If a team member can try several things and fail in a work session, then the idea of safety can start to take hold. It's not just a solution that will work. It's many things that could work. They won't know until they try them. Being in a state of flow lets them explore that. I love the look on people's faces and how they talk about things when they're in this state. Their focus is really intense. The learning that is actually occurring, you can see it happening. A common complaint here is that it's not making the most efficient use of our resources. And that's probably true. That's not what we're after, though. We want the work to flow, not to be stopped because one person isn't there today or is the only one that knows that bit of code. There's a great series by Joanna Rothman about the fact that we want the feature flows to be efficient, not the resource utilization. That level of who does what for how long violates a lot of basic agile tenets and doesn't allow the team members to finish work. It might mean the work is slower if added all the pieces up, but you know what? It's also likely done a hell of a lot sooner. Our focus should be used here as well. If I know I need to send out the release notes for our latest release, I need to dedicate 20 minutes, at least, to pull that info from Jira, check it, and then send out the notification that it's out there. I've done that enough, and I have a repeatable process to get it started and out. I still need time dedicated to getting it done, though. Trying to get it complete in 5-minute batches throughout the day isn't going to get it finished, and it'll take longer than 20 minutes because of the starts and stops while other things get done. Multitasking is the devil. I'll say it again. Sometimes I do a little bit of work on things while on calls or other things, just a little bit. But for work that I absolutely need to get done, I have my dedicated time during the day to finish it. I can also apply this to the users of our products. Yes, we want them to have a good flow through the app. What about the 20 other things that are connected to that workflow? Once they do one task, where do they go next? What else do they want to do? Imagine your users in a state of flow in your application. What would that look like? What would it mean to them? I have a particular challenge that I really want to solve. Our best estimates, until we look at the data, of course, is that a particular person or persona can do very common and necessary activity 150 times a day. We have tons of these activities and therefore a bunch of people doing them. My initial goal is to let them be 3 times more effective in that activity. So they could be doing almost 500 items a day in less time. However, what if that 150 items is only half of what they have to do in the application? What if what is slowing them down is not the application workflow, it's actually the switching from our app to another one or email or a website to look something up? What if our new workflow works and they still can't increase their items because they can't stay in flow for some reason? If it's related to the product, how can we remove that friction for them? That leaves the third flow area and the one that I'm most interested in, which is the actual flow of work that we need to do. The books, videos, and other information I've been sharing have really been focused on making the work flow through the system better. The theory of constraints is about constantly reducing the impact that the bottlenecks have in your system. This can increase flow. There's a great practical video of this that you can watch online. In it, a 2-liter bottle is emptied in different ways that showcase how changes to the way that it's emptied can increase the rate of flow and the stability in the system. I just picked up another great classic book in the space that I haven't read yet, Lean Thinking, and flow is a big piece of it. The value stream map is a very good tool to use here to show the times that work is in progress and where it waits. Then you can see how long it takes from touch time, which is people actively doing things that contribute to the work, and where it sits idle as waste. Odds are when you do this for your own work, you can see the majority of time a story or a bug or anything else really is set aside waiting to be acted upon. The time it takes to make a decision, move it to another department, get an answer, whatever else stops the item from moving to the next step is a MUTA level activity and should be removed from the flow. The easiest targets and the most obvious targets for showing the flow in the system is to make it visible. Boards and other methods show where the work is and ideally how long it's been there. You need to have this data in order to show where things are stuck, where flow is not occurring. I've used just a simple visualization from a team's Kanban board to show the impact of UAT or delay in making decisions or deploying code to production. Just showing this and showing the team and the stakeholders, then asking questions about it is very powerful. Hi, everyone. We've gotten a story that's been in this code review column for 4 days now. Does anyone know why? Or maybe we've been waiting for an answer from sales for 14 days on this custom report. When can we get an answer? One of the best pieces of advice was that the board should reflect your process. If the process sucks and the board starts looking like it sucks, that's okay. Now you know what to improve. Don't try to make it perfect before you start tackling it. This way you can keep referring back to it during your Kaizen or continuous improvement steps. Reducing your work in progress, or as John Cutler recently proposed, promises in progress, will help lead to a better flow. As less work is started, more work can be finished. As that work does get finished, then you can pull in work when the flow can be maintained. Finished work should count toward velocity or credit for the team, and only finished work. Unfinished work is not great, but sometimes necessary. The trick, then, is to make it as low as possible. In addition to keeping track of our cycle time and lead time, which all measure completed flow, I've started keeping track of inventory. Using what I've learned from Goldratt and others, any work that has been started and is not finished, I count as inventory. Inventory is generally bad, especially for software teams. Keeping track of how many stories or epics are in progress and how long they've been there, we've been able to reduce the time it takes us to get work done. We've also identified several items that have been outstanding for ridiculous amounts of time. Work that hasn't started yet isn't nearly as bad as work that hasn't finished. Being able to focus on fewer things means our defects can be corrected as soon as they are created. No waiting around for a test cycle, just fix it now. It means the productivity of the teams will increase, as I mentioned before, if the system optimizes and is focused on the flow of work and not who's working on it. Work can actually get done faster. One of our teams had a great August sprint because of two main things. First, we dedicated the majority, or around 80% of the sprint, to a single epic, no multitasking. That team then also took on the other pieces that needed to be done, and in the past, it would have been done by another team, to make the data show up in our other products. They learned this new area and are able to push to production these new changes all by themselves. This reduced the time to complete the epic from 2 months to just one. And what a result it was. Customers get their needs met sooner. Teams gain confidence in seeing work done. Stakeholders see that the process works and that the product now has more value. And product owners can prioritize the next bit of work. Where's the downside in any of that? Also, since the work is actually getting done, you can be more flexible. When work doesn't drag on, when it actually finishes, you can start something new. Otherwise, you have so many things in progress. How do you know what the real priority is? How do you know if it changes? You can't react. If your stories are small and getting done quickly, you can move and pivot better. The team is not setting work to the side or stopping to do something else. You're just done. Something I found in Bob Marshall's Flow Chain Sensei info that I'll link to in the show notes is the notion of not flowing value or discussing value as much as needs. So the things that we build for the customer should be about their needs, and that flow of needs should be what we strive for. He has a great quote, "Customers buy features, not your busyness." Hopefully by putting these pieces together, you can see that flow is a great thing for product owners to be concerned with from multiple angles. Our users' ability to get done what they need, our team members being able to work, or the work flowing through the system. The concept of flow is key. It's quickly rising up my list of items to focus on and repeat ad nauseum, along with the word focus. Focus and flow enable each other. They help teams produce great work. They help your user become awesome. They make your product valuable sooner. And I like that very much. If you have any feedback or any questions about product ownership, you can contact the show on Twitter at DeliberateCast, or you can email the show at DeliberateCast@gmail.com. A lot of people have been contacting me on LinkedIn, which is pretty cool too, so feel free to do that. If you do enjoy the show, please share it with a friend, tell them why you love it, and while you're at it, you can leave us a rating and review. A question from a listener today, Barry, who hit me up on LinkedIn, said, I have one team that estimates their story points by estimating a story point from the devs and another story point from the QA and adding them together. Boo. Multiple people have tried, but the team won't change this. The dev won't estimate QA work as it's not their job. In other words, they have a Scrummer fall. My other two internal teams, Barry says, are the opposite. They consider themselves delivery teams, estimate as a team, and even dev assists with QA towards the end of a sprint if needed. Very cool. The biggest issue, he says, is that the team that won't do this has a senior dev on the team, and he tends to be quite stubborn on changing habits. One thing the team is great at is having all stories ready for QA by the time the sprint is due to end. So classic Scrummer fall in one team, and your other two teams seem to be doing things very good. Scrummer fall is where you dev in one sprint, tests in another sprint, so you're not working together. And it's really obvious there, Barry, from the dev does their estimate, QA does their estimate, they're not seeing themselves as a team. A couple things there. I would try to heighten as much as I can the good examples that you have. You've got two teams that are doing it well. You got two teams that are doing it right. I would try to promote, celebrate, do whatever I can to make those two teams the apple of my eye or see how valuable the work they're doing is, especially if you can point to areas in the other team where that process and the way they're doing things is slowing them down. It's causing them issues. It's causing them more bugs. Can you get a bug count? Is that worth it? Can you show that, you know, how far ahead dev is from test and the fact that the work's not done, the work takes, again, go back to our flow conversation. How long does it take to get the work done, a story done in team A versus the other two teams? It sounds like it'll be at least double because of the testing cycles. So try to gather, I guess my first thing would be try to gather as much data as you can with your Scrum Master and from the teams and see how they compare and then talk to the team that you're having issues with about that and see what they think. Just propose it to them. Hey, this is what we're seeing. This is also what we're able to accomplish with some of the other teams by changing the ways we work. What's preventing us from doing it on this team? And let them answer that question. And if they can't answer it, then you've got some other things that you can try, especially if it's just one senior dev on the team. If there's one person who's holding up the change, it's worth it to have a conversation with him. It's worth it to have a conversation with a team without him. It's worth having a conversation with the dev managers and asking their opinion about things and trying to see, you know, what the big problem is. Dev and test estimating separately, that's a good first hurdle to try to solve. Maybe it's because there's too much work in progress. Maybe it's because they don't want to work with the testers. Again, things you need to kind of flush out and see, are you at a really impossible pass because of the people on the team don't want to work that way? Is it an option that, you know, you can have them do something else? There's lots of things that you try to do to mitigate it, which is not the best case. The best case is, you know, they see the value, they start practicing the value, they start changing their behaviors and everything else. Really work with the coaches, really work with your managers, and really work with the teams primarily to kind of show what impact that is having when they do things like that. Especially if those teams are sitting together, if those three teams are within proximity to each other, that's a really powerful thing to kind of model and use that as positive reinforcement for those good teams. So I don't know if that helps, Barry. That's a really sticky situation, something I've been in myself as well. And that's kind of what I've done is just work the best I can and try to show value and show that the process works and show that there's a particular problem that needs to be addressed, particular impediment that needs to be addressed, and work with the teams. And if the teams aren't able to solve that problem, then work with management and kind of work through it that way. Agile is not easy. Again, this is part of the hard part about Agile is getting teams to be open and honest and reactive and change their behaviors. And if they're not willing to change their behaviors, sometimes certain people have to go. I don't care what they know or how long they've been there. If they're not willing to work this way, that's a good tell of your organization is how much are they willing to change and how much are they willing to stake? Are they willing to do what's necessary to see this adoption and see this transformation that you guys are going through or this journey you guys are going on through to completion? That's a big tell. So if that helps, Barry, that's the only question we'll do today. And Barry, hit me up if you want either a product owner t-shirt, which I've put on Twitter, or if you want a copy of Bob's book with a bookmark from Kim. All right. That's going to be it for this episode. All opinions expressed here are mine. You can find more of them, plus some rants, at Is Corey Bryan on Twitter. And that is episode 61, Delivered, Go Out, and Own Your Outcome. This show is part of the Agile Podcast Network. For more shows and information, visit agilepodcastnetwork.com.